things. So we have the call to order. So we have Mr. Updike.
Here.
Mr. Berman.
Here.
Mr. Hanselman.
He's here.
Mr. Braulio.
Here.
Cupcake Escobar.
Oh.
And Mr. Bear.
Here.
Okay, and I welcome everybody to the Fund Committee, as Nina said. Remember that?
Yeah,
I
do.
That's right.
I do.
Okay, so we have new business 2A, the Bayfront parking statistics, the peak season comparison. And there's a PowerPoint and a large format of the Bayfront, so you can understand where all the various
parking areas are.
Bill spends some quality time serving on that committee, but I just provided a similar summary for our Parking Advisory Committee in its last meeting, but I did add in a few additional items, which I'll be passing along to them as well.
Yeah,
so that I just kind of run through this. It kind of touched on some questions that some of the Parking Committee members had, and we didn't have that data, so I went ahead and added it in. So I'm just going to run through them. We have our city recorder was going through city's archives and ran across a number of scrapbooks from the different years. And I pulled this one from two or three scrapbooks from the late 70s, but had panned through and actually saw this, you know, this topic comes up periodically every few years. But I actually appreciate it. I mean, I think the photo was great. It shows that, you know, parking congestion issues are nothing new for the Bayfront, for the city. The solutions really, it's funny, out of this one, they ended up purchasing the Canyon Way parking lot, but eventually ran out of surface lot areas to buy and or construct. Parking study, been there, done that. You know, Bayfront bus, that didn't materialize there, but that's continues to be a topic of discussion about, you know, enhanced transit down through there and what it would take and what it would cost and how it would be paid for. So, thought you'd appreciate that. So, this peak season versus last season, transactions are up a little bit, and that corresponded with what we heard from at least Janelle at the and they own a couple of businesses down there, and she said traffic's been up. So this lined up with that. And you can see this is typical. I mean, the level of activity starting in May through October is a pretty consistent little curve there. You know, back when we did the parking study, it was an observed turnover rate of, you know, average stay length of 2 hours and 38 minutes, and the best we have as a corollary is average transaction. Our average transaction 24 was $2.24, and 25, $2.26. But if you want to correlate that to the actual length of stay, that would put us at a little over, you know, 10 minutes better in terms of turnover rates. Is it perfect? No. You know, some people pay more, end up staying less, some pay less, and, you know, roll the dice that parking enforcement's not going to go there if they overstay for 10, 15, 20 minutes. I mean, so it's going to run the gamut a little bit, but it's the best we can do to kind of provide ourselves.
What is the guideline on that for the parking enforcement? Is there any grace period at all?
Nope. So you just roll the dice on that. But, you know, what it tells me, though, is, I mean, is it appears that we're getting better turnover rate. And it's in part because it has certainly changed parking behavior. You see people who had been parking in prime spots now parking further away. And those spaces are available and they're utilized and we get a little bit better turnover rate. The next couple of slides are about revenue by type. As I know, the April-May permits, I throw April in there because all your renewals come in late April or, you know, moving forward. A lot of them do, as you can see. So you have a lot of permit revenue in that particular month, but then it's pay station. Well, it's mobile pay and then pay station. And then I think the biggie here, and we talked about it briefly at the Parking Advisory Committee, was the fact that in 2024, utilization of the kiosks versus the mobile pay was pretty close to 50-50, a little bit more with mobile pay than pay station. But that's dropped significantly. You get into 25 and look, 2/3 of our transactions now are mobile pay, phone. Which makes sense. People who started using it, once you've got that all programmed in, it's really easy. And I think it's the world we're in. Because you saw, the other thing we see is that while cash, or basically coin payments, are still there, they're a very small percentage of our overall transactions. Started at 3% in 24, now they're down to under 2%.
Does the data on mobile pay allow us to see repeat users by mobile pay?
We'll have to dig into that. Theoretically, yes, because we have their license plate. Every time a transaction is picked up, we'll have the license plate number. The trick for me is, can I tease that out of the system?
Right.
And the reporting that I've seen so far is I haven't seen something there that would allow me to do that. But I can look at it a little bit more. It's a good question.
Yeah, it might.
And that's a good question.
It might be meaningless data, but it might be interesting. I just wonder what it is.
Yeah, okay.
The
bulk of our transactions are on the West End. I think that's really what the revenue by location shows. Abbey Street lot and Bay Street over on the West End are the ones that get the most use. Abbey Street by clear number one.
Well, that's the biggest lot too, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Right, and then the others, it's kind of a mix. What I do find interesting is, see the difference between 24 and 25 over at Herbert, Lee, and the West Boardwalk, we enhanced the signage between 24 and 25, and not coincidentally, we got more mobile pay use over in that area, and better utilization in that area. So we got more in the way of collections back over there. Mobile pay and the pay stations are your bulk here. Permits are significant, and then tickets are pretty modest. And we were talking before the meeting, and then we'll get to this slide too. Our ticket, the number of tickets issued over that period of time, May to October, is relatively close to equal between the 2 years, but our collections are half of what they were the first year, this year. So they were 30-something thousand down to 15-something thousand. And a lot of that has to do with just a lower collection rate. And so that's something that our police department and our office are going to look into and see, okay, is there some pattern here? Like people saying, oh, there's no ramifications if I don't pay a ticket, so I just won't pay them. So are we seeing a uptick on that front? And if so, what should we do? I mean, you know, certainly the city does have the boot, and it can utilize that. But that means one, you catch the vehicle in that location at that point in time, the police department, and it's in a location where a boot could actually be deployed and would work on that particular vehicle. So there are a lot of variables that go into that if they're going to do that.
What's the chief's intention? Is he willing to get into that kind of enforcement, that level of enforcement?
I think first we want to figure out, is there a pattern that we need to be honing in on? Like, you know, the increase in people just simply not paying tickets, as opposed to it just being a quirky year where we, you know, for a number of reasons, the collection rate was lower, but not necessarily because of, you know, people just repeatedly going down there and blowing off tickets. So we need to dig into it a little bit further to get a better understanding. And that reduced collection rate is something to that caught our attention. We need to look at it more carefully. So,
Derek, in your memo, you suggest that the city might want to adjust pricing moving forward. Was the philosophy to generate income with the parking scheme? Was the philosophy to create turnover so that there'd be more parking and people would park?
Both. There were two prongs to this. Yeah, we wanted better turnover, but we also wanted to make sure that we were generating enough revenue not only to cover the cost of running the program, but to generate enough additional revenue that we could start tackling some of these things that folks want to see, such as enhanced, let's get a transit route going. You know, well, that's going to cost money. It's going to cost money to pay bus drivers, and it's going to cost money to, you know, purchase and maintain vehicles. Or at some point, folks have kicked around. Maybe we do we start using these revenues to finance the construction of a parking garage. Long-term play, but you have to have a consistent revenue stream above and beyond just maintaining the program to make it happen. This was just getting at what zones, and I included the map, and the Zone A permits are the most popular. That includes the Abbey Street lot. That's the prime parking areas, Bay Street lot, Fall Street. Those are all the kind of the prime parking areas that are closest to all of the activity, and they're the ones that are most popular in terms of utilization, and that's what you get out of here. And this is just another way of teasing this out, but it does include some of the other permits that don't fit by zone. For example, our charter fishing generates over $10,000 a year in parking permits for recreational fishing charters. And, you know, they do those as a day pass. And, so it fits in some of those other ones. They aren't specific to zones, but again, as you can see, the Zone A and the Zone C are your biggies, and then it tapers off. Some of these over here on the far right-hand side, like the Zone C and D monthly, we don't have a lot of traffic there, so those are candidates that maybe we don't need those permits because we just don't have a lot of use there, and it just adds clutter when people are trying to find and navigate the system and determine what they want to do. Those are both zones that offer annual discount, $100 for the entire year permits, and that's where people have gravitated to. They just go for the annual permit because that makes the most sense to them. They work down there, and that's fairly cost-effective when you consider it applies all 12 months. This compared the level of activity from parking enforcement year one and parking enforcement year two, and I think it goes to show it's highly variable in terms of the level of activity that a parking enforcement officer is, you know, when they're issuing tickets and not. And I think we have to keep in mind, we have one parking enforcement officer. They take vacations. They're not always going to be the same each year. You know, they're just, you know, weather will become a factor sometimes. I mean, so, you know, we shouldn't expect that there's going to be a uniform number of tickets issued through the summer. That's not how it works. It varies based on, you know, that particular parking enforcement person. And we're going to have a third one now because we're recruiting for next year, because both of our last two, after having served for a year, have taken positions in the police department as officers. Which, yeah, it's kind of a double-edged sword on that. I mean, on the one hand, it's, you know, we're going on a third parking enforcement officer and we're having to recruit it, which means we really don't have somebody effectively there for the off-season. But it also means we're starting to get a depth of knowledge on pay station maintenance and all of that because we have multiple people in the police department know how to handle that. So if we need coverage at some point for a short period of time, one of those officers can step into that role and take care of that for a short period of time, for example. Not that they necessarily are going to want to, but, I mean, it's an option available. Improper parking is by far the biggest violation type. I mean, so that would be parking without a permit. That's where you would run into this. The overtime parking would be if they actually paid, but they overstayed what they paid. So that falls into the all other. And you do have, you know, a variety of different types of violations. We do issue violations for oversized vehicles when they extend too far out and they get into the travel lane. That there are a number of those, but they're a relatively small percentage of the overall. The largest one is improper parking, and that's true for both years.
Any thoughts as to why it would be so much, the all others would be so such a smaller percentage?
It's just, this is the most common. You know,
So I mean, between the 2 years.
You know, part of that makes me wonder if it was how the particular parking enforcement individual logged them in, because that's how we capture this. So it may be, you know, I don't want to put, you know, but Corin may have just been more inclined to log a citation as improper parking, whereas maybe Donald had a finer screen on that. It's just humor, user preferences to a point. All right, this is your average ticket life cycle, and I try to make it as clear as possible, and this is always one that generates questions. But the point here is what we use it for is, what is our relative collection? At what point I think, what was Jason saying? It's a little over 40% is your typical collection rate on parking tickets across many, many jurisdictions, your typical average. Parking tickets are not something you expect you're going to be collecting at 70, 80%. It's just not something that typically falls there. We had a very good collection rate year one, and we had a very good response rate before notice was sent. So these are folks that paid after they got their ticket. We didn't have to bug them with a follow-up notice. Paid after notice sent, you know, again, you know, we picked up another good chunk there. And then collections, which is pretty typical. That's your lowest number that you're going to pick up at that point, because by the time you get to collections, you're getting to folks that were probably disinclined to pay the ticket in the first place. Collections is bugging them to try to get it.
So can you explain the day number? Is that like an average?
This is on average, you know, so for all those tickets that are issued day one, so we issued 3,284 tickets in 24, 1,750 of those paid before notice was sent. So they promptly paid. You can pay right there off your phone when you get a ticket. So by the time we get, you know, notice.
And 1,750 paid on average the sixth day after they were issued a ticket. Is that what the six means? What does the six mean?
No, day six. That's day six in the life cycle of the ticket. The notice would go out.
I'm just having trouble reconciling the 25 data with the 24 data with the day numbers. But maybe it has to do with it being 10 months and 25 and 12 and 24, or what? What's the deal?
That's a good question. I'd have to go back and double check that. I'm looking at three over here, but I don't know. I guess I paid more attention to the title and the count than I do the day and its life cycle. But
okay.
That should be more or less, we're getting a lot of those tickets on 2024 were paid fairly early in, you know, before we got to a point where notice was sent out.
Who dismisses the 20 tickets that are shown there?
Dismissals happen a few different ways. Most of the dismissals are coming from the parking enforcement officer, because they you're going to have parking enforcement determine that they shouldn't issue the ticket because, one common one would be folks who had a disabled parking placard and didn't have it displayed, and they follow up with their placard, and we dismiss that one. I've seen that multiple times.
All right.
But there are a few other ways. Sometimes it'll be a, hey, I tried to pay, but I was having a problem with the computer, and we go back because we know when the things cycle down for, and, oh, you were at X pay station and it was offline. you know, those are some of those things that get sorted out afterwards.
Okay, this isn't, okay, yeah, that's fine.
So did not we, by many. But the, I mean, striking is the change in numbers, so were there more glitches, or is this related to, is this a parking control officer decision on dismissal as to why there was 76 in 1 year and 10 times the amount in the second year?
That's something for us to take a look at. Why that? I don't know.
So that's a
it's a big difference.
Change, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, it could be, couldn't it just be the parking officer? Because we had two different parking officers.
Right. I don't know. Yeah, that, we'd have to look into that further.
And then is there a rationale for why the notice sent number is also so strikingly different?
Different.
585.
Yeah, part of me wants to go and take a look at that and see, did somehow something in the back end of that, that's an auto report. Can we pull out if there's something hinky in the auto report on that one?
I just wonder if the 29 notices is right. That might explain why the revenue collection is so low.
No joke, yeah.
Right? Okay.
This just shows that we're kind of treading water on collections. We came in at just under 400,000 for 24-25. And when you back out a lot of the costs, you know, I mean, you're not, you don't, you know, we're there, but we're just kind of treading water. Remember, the debt was for a lot paving we did. So we did about 250,000 in lot paving before we launched on the Bayfront. We got to pay that off. So
that's like a 5 year, 6 year.
Yeah, that's that was an interfund loan that we're paying off over time. Yeah, at $45,000 increments. Fun stuff. So we are working with the Parking Advisory Committee on, we had agreed to defer Nye Beach to 26, so we're starting to gear up for reaching out to folks again to get the Nye Beach component up and running. That will help with the making the program work and balance out a little bit better, because our parking enforcement does spend a fair amount of time in Nye Beach. Parking tickets included in here include Nye Beach and other parts of the city, not just the Bayfront. And it will help, as because we've made a commitment to drive these funds back into the parking districts, that having more than just the Bayfront, you know, where we're generating money, will help with an equity concerns from businesses who say, hey, wait a minute, you know, why are you using these funds to repair a parking lot in Nye Beach when they were almost all generated in the Bayfront? How is that fair? So we'll get through that.
You think the political appetite is there to chase that in 26?
We'll see.
Or are you going to be deferred to 27?
Well, you know, one big difference, you know, we were almost there, and it was just, we also did run out of time. It was getting compressed there to get it all rolled out. But you do know, too, that, you know, that having the state parks now charge for parking in South Beach and Beverly Beach, you know, that kind of tempers the argument that, well, what happened, you know, this free beach access. Well, no, you know, the state's doing it too, because they have to be able to maintain these assets that you're using. It's no different than what we're doing or need to do. I mean, when you look at the Nye Beach turnaround in particular, and you look at that giant retaining wall on the north end that dates back, what, to the 40s, you know, these types of facilities will require maintenance, and at some point will have to be replaced, and it's not cheap. You know, and yes, to some degree, we can use room tax for some of these things. But again, we're using room tax to maintain buildings like the Performing Arts Center and the Visual Arts Center. We can't use room tax to do all of it. And there are limits on what we can use that for. And we continually try to get a little bit more flexibility from the legislature. We get this close and it doesn't happen. So,
is there any chance the legislature is going to change that allocation?
There's always a chance. They get really close this last session. It got through the House and stalled in the Senate. So that might be that might just light the fire under the hotel lobby to say, hey, look, we got to cut a deal because, you know, we can only fend it off so many times. At some point, you know, we either step up and work with the local governments on something that's more palatable, or we're going to get something that we don't like. All right, so we have on that one.
Okay, next up is scope of work for the rental housing maintenance program for small and mid-sized cities.
Okay. So you may recall that as part of our housing production strategy, one of the items in there, and I think one of the more popular items with folks who we surveyed when we were putting together that housing production strategy, involves the city looking into whether or not it's feasible to stand up a program that provides some oversight on the habitability of market rate rental units. Not affordable units. Affordable units are already received that kind of oversight through the Oregon Housing Community Services. It would be market rate units here where people said, hey, look, I'm paying a lot of money to stay here, and this unit has condition problems, and there's nobody for me to really get that sorted out with. I try to do that with the management of the place, and they don't deal with it. And so there are jurisdictions that tackle this, but this can be really resource intensive in terms of staff, and it can be fairly costly as well. And so the tact we took, this was a second attempt. This one was successful for us to get some funding from the state. The first one was we were looking for the state to I put together a scope of work where we would be looking at a program in Newport specifically, and they were, well, that's great, but you guys might not implement, and then we're out the money. How about reframing it as a toolkit that, you know, could work for you in Newport, but, you know, if you don't do it, it might work for another community of similar size. So this go around, I went ahead and put this scope of work together, which was attached to the application. And reminded them that they had provided some advice to kind of restructure it this way. And lo and behold, it was approved, and it will be funded. And we are on target for a kickoff around January. This one, because it's a toolkit that could be used in a lot of different jurisdictions, I didn't see the need for us to manage the consulting contract, because the way the state sets us up, you could do it one of two ways. You either manage it in-house or you let them manage it. And because this could be a resource for multiple jurisdictions, I'm like, okay, it probably makes the most sense for let them manage this one. Nonetheless, once they approved them, they did send out a poll about whether or not we had a preference on a consultant, and I told them no preference because I really didn't want to go down that rabbit hole. And I don't know that there really is a reason to. This is not something that, oh, you did our housing production strategy, so you're that much better positioned to do this. This is a distinct project. I think any consultant with capacity can do this. And so they went and assigned. It's going to be Cascadia Partners is who they picked. And I hope and trust that, you know, they were looking at that with capacity in mind, because that's usually my biggest concern, is just make sure to pick somebody who actually has the staff and time to do it. But beyond that, I mean, Eco Northwest helped us with the housing production strategy, but that was a distinct project with a distinct end date. There's no reason why they needed to necessarily take this one on too. So anyway, here's the
Did they essentially agree to your budget? Because I know that's just a suggestion in your application, but I noticed also they said subject to funding. So how do you align scope with the budget if you don't know the budget?
Well, I think the way this is going to work is we got to hammer out the scope, and then they'll tell us if that causes issues on the budget side. So I mean, that's my best guess at this point.
Okay.
You know, I put that together. I didn't have to, you know, but it's my practice on that kind of stuff. And it may or may not be, you know, exactly on par on here. I will say anytime we're doing public engagement, that's going to start to jack up. The more engagement you do, the more expensive it's going to be because it eats up a lot of time, consultant time. A lot of this, you know, the research and whatnot shouldn't be that hard. There are a number of these programs out there, but it's compiling them and taking a hard look at them and are they a good fit based on how smaller jurisdictions are resourced. But for purposes of this discussion, I wanted to kind of go through the scope of work. And we're at a point in time where, as we go through this, if there's some thoughts, please put them on the table because I'll be having a conversation with Cascadia Partners here in the coming weeks to go over the scope. And this is the time, if there's any additional items that you think we ought to include or tweak, it's a good time to put them on the table. So I'll just go through it in turn here.
Derek, can you point to any specific instance where a tenant has not been able to use the existing landlord-tenant law to affect the habitability concerns that a unit has to have? You know, plumbing, heating, roof, garbage. I'm just wondering why the city would venture into an area that can be resolved between the tenant and the landlord. I mean, there's legal mechanisms in place for
sure.
Both sides.
Sure. No, that's a fair question, Braulio. But I guess my response to it is we had agreed to do this as part of our housing production strategy, because through the development of that and the engagement of folks in the community, we got a lot of feedback on surveys that this is something they thought the city should step into because they were not finding a way to resolve it by other means. Now, we didn't go back out and talk to every single person who filled out a survey and said, well, have you pursued, you know, hiring an attorney or these certain legal mechanisms? We didn't do that. But what we did hear through doing the housing production strategy from a number of responders was that we needed to look into this issue. At the end of the day, the council may not want to do it.
It just seems that by adding another layer of to, you know, a housing issue, you're going to end up with increased rents. And your housing production strategy already said that, you know, there's so many people who aren't able to find housing in that 30-35% of their disposable income range. And so you're going to make folks even more burdened as rents rise to cover the cost of another agency.
Okay.
I think it's something that should be considered.
Well, I agree with that, Braulio, but I also think that this becomes rather onerous for the city, in that they are now engaging in the rental market by requiring some kind of certification, mm-hmm. inspections, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And if they're going to insert themselves in that, I think they will find themselves more often than in the past stuck between a renter and a landlord. And I don't think that's what the city really wants to be doing.
Hey, Sherry, I think we lost this.
You know, I think the city of Eugene has a program such as this, and maybe I should look
at
how that's working.
He's included some information about that, but
yeah,
it does seem like you're committing the city now to doing a lot more negotiations or what's the correct word for mediation?
Right.
And I don't think that's really what the city should be getting into or wants to get into.
And Braulio, I looked at Eugene, and it's really interesting to see how that has morphed over the last few years from what was a simple maintenance program, an ability for a renter to come to the city and say, my landlord's not giving me heat or whatever, and they try to resolve the issue. And it morphed into a very comprehensive rental program that mirrors a lot of state laws about relocation assistance, rent capping, just issues that are already sort of covered at the state level, and now they're inserting themselves in regulating landlords. It's turned into a different program than what it started with a few years ago. So it's really interesting to see the subsequent ordinances that Eugene passed to ratchet it up. And I think the next thing is they're going to find their fee, which staff stated is the lowest in the state at $10 a rental unit. That's going to go up because they added, you know, a ton of scope to what they're doing. I was just wondering whether you have a political insight as to where this is. This a toe in the water to something else, or is this it as far as you know from a city council standpoint?
I don't know that. I mean, any program could be suspect to mission creep over time.
Yeah,
but. I think it's fairly narrowly tailored right now, and it's do we even want to do this? I think it's, I mean, I'll jot down here, Braulio, that maybe we have the consultant spend a little bit of time kind of framing out how effective the existing process is. I don't know if I really captured that in there.
Now's the time we can say, can we resurrect Lee Hardy and have her come in and chime in? Some of us who are older can recall Lee, who was she was not afraid to speak her piece.
Yeah,
that's
no.
For sure.
Yeah, my main concern with the whole thing is that there is the potential, in extreme circumstances, to reduce the housing supply by implementing a program like that. You got somebody that's running one of these slumlord buildings, and all of a sudden the city comes to him and says, oh, you've got to fix the hole in the roof and all the broken windows. And they say, well, screw it, I just won't rent it anymore. I'm not making that much off it anyway, and shut her down. Now, I don't know whether that's, I don't think like a landlord, because I'm not, but... I just worry that any extra pressure on the landlords could result in a reduced housing supply rather than the intended safer or better housing supply. I think it's a danger. But I think that it's well worthwhile to scope this out, but I think that it has one of the options to come out of this whole exercise should be it's not worth doing.
You know, Bob,
for one reason or another.
To kind of follow through on what you're saying, it's probably a program like this would probably affect the mom and pop landlord. The developers, like we heard with right. The last couple of weeks, you know, they're professionals. And they want to maintain their building. And last thing they want is disgruntled tenants either destroying the place or having leaking roofs or whatever. So I think the impact would probably fall down to the smaller landlord.
Yeah, that's probably true. That would be someone like me. My wife and I have had rental properties for now probably close to 30 years. Never more than two at a time. And they were right on the same block of 11 houses that we lived on. So, and we had, as we do here in Newport, our clientele is entirely Hatfield, OSU students or professionals working for the Department of Agriculture or the U.S. Fish and Game. Well, anyways, they're all researchers and whatnot. And we rent an oceanfront property, 800 square feet. We rent it for $1,000.
Oh, gosh.
Which is $500 below. At least below what we could get to it. And we do that because my wife and I were lucky to have sponsors through life, people who stepped up and helped us one way or another. I kind of believe in karma. So I'd like to earn as much as I can if I'm going to go anyplace after this. but a lot of mom and pop landlords operate... You know, it's we did it so that we could buy in Michigan so that we could buy this house in Newport, and it came with a second dwelling on it. And it was
it's a kind of a ADU before ADUs were a thing. We had University of Michigan graduate students that stayed in their properties in Ann Arbor. They were responsible. They passed the party age. They passed all that craziness. They're really at a tough university working on, you know, a master's degree, you know, architecture, dentistry, a cello, musicians, you know, kind of serious people. They didn't trash our place. And the people we get from Hatfield don't. You find a clientele that you can feed into, and then you rent to them over and over. We never run a rental ad. When someone's leaving our places, they always bring a really good candidate. So that's, you know, people who are begging to get that cottage on Agate Beach. My point is, if you get the right clientele, renting is great. It's easy. We get to give back to people like what happened to my wife and I when we were younger. So it's a win-win-win. But I don't like things that become onerous. I don't like things like rent control. I mean, that's just, you know, people are going to pack up and not do rental when you make it too hard. You know, we're not lawyers. You know, we do it on hopefully the smarts we have. So these kinds of programs always make me jiggle a little bit because I don't really know what the cause of this when we have city ordinances that deal with certificates of occupancy and things like that in many communities. And there's ways to take care of any property. Here's our nuisance, and we know that the nuisance rules here are tough to enforce. We were going to deal with some of that. I guess we did deal with some of that. But there might be other ways to do this very same thing without making it onerous on small landlords, that kind of a thing.
I got that down.
Thank you.
Our commitment was to assess the feasibility. That's the commitment we made as part of the housing production strategy. And I think this is a good way to go about it. I think as part of this process, and if I could just real quick kind of run through the kind of the scope of work, is we're committing our time to bring in other people to help inform the consultants. This is probably not something they do on a day-to-day basis in terms of putting this type of toolkit together, so getting some others in. So we got a formation of a technical advisory committee, which is common. You know, we pull together there'll be rental owners as part of that, but then building safety, you know, people that are familiar with housing laws, get an attorney in there, that kind of stuff. I do have a number of contacts outside of the city of Newport, try to get some other community engaged. This would be a toolkit for multiple communities, not just us. So we can help them with that. You know, we're looking at kickoff in January. You know, this is where we have a chance to kind of just make sure we're all on the same page relative to the scope of work, get them background information. Legal considerations would be a memo as part of this. There are already a lot of laws in the books. We're not looking to duplicate. We already talked about that. So I think just getting a good sense of the legal framework that's out there. And I jotted down, you know, also with a critical eye towards any stats that can be pulled in about the effectiveness of those existing processes would be helpful as part of this too.
Is it clear that this is only intended to be a toolkit for renters of 30 days or more? It says no impact to STRs or?
It shouldn't. No.
I don't know that that's stated anywhere, but.
No, it's good. I'll make sure it gets clear.
Another sort of definitional question was, what's a small to medium sized city? California boy has one thought in his head, but Oregon maybe has a different one.
the state actually defines that in the land use context. So any city under 2,500 would be small. They fit it. And actually, you probably could throw those under 10,000 by purposes of certain regulations as small, and then 10 to 25 would tend to be your midsize.
Got it. Okay.
We're just We are the small mid-sized.
We actually are we are a medium-sized city under land use rules because we're above 10,000 population, and that's the triggering mechanism. All right, so that was legal considerations. Stakeholder issue identification would be a significant piece of this.
Excuse me, I'm sorry. You were talking about the advisory committee.
Mm-hmm.
Seems like you went through a list of things and but didn't include any renters. I didn't see that on your list.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's any organized groups of renters, like maybe the people that are in housing authority housing, do they have some structure organization to? I honestly don't know, but
okay,
that might be something to look at as a representative of a group of.
Okay, renters. I got it. Rental advocates.
Renters union.
There you go. Sorry, that just popped back in my head.
No, that's a good idea.
That's fine.
On the flip side of that, there is a landlord kind of association. They don't have any groups in this county, but I noticed they're kind of around us and certainly in the Wilmette Valley and in Portland. So.
No good, I got
but
that.
But I don't know how much landlord input we need, right?
I think we very much need it because, look, these programs are commonly funded by some sort of additional business license assessment on rental units or whatever. You have to have something to run the program. Anyway, no, that's good. That's good.
I would encourage, if you do landlords, then you have a varying size ownership. I mean, people who own a couple rental units versus those who own 20, 30,
right.
40, 50. It's an entirely different business model, I'm sure.
And I want to emphasize, this has got to be more focused on the market rate. Because when you get into the affordable, they've already got covenants and restrictions imposed by whoever provided the bulk of the funding, which is generally public, as we know. You know, so that's usually Oregon Housing Community Services, but you may have HUD in there too. And there are existing programs already in place for affordable housing to address that. So this is more market rate.
Yeah.
So I'll try to make that clear too. Go ahead.
Are you saying then that a housing development with 100 units that has 20 affordable units, that's two separate processes that they would go through to resolve any issues?
If it's a big,
quite very likely, yes. Because see, those 20 affordable units are likely to have some sort of restrictions that were imposed on them related to the funding that require certain levels of maintenance and things, and the state will step in and.
That's what happens. The state does step in.
Yep.
For those big. I've dealt with that before.
Okay, it just seems weird, two different authorities.
And they have more of the way, and they have hooks because of the public funding that was used to construct the facility in the first place. So their ability to enforce is, I think, a little bit more powerful.
Okay. The landlord organization I had in mind was the Oregon Rental Housing Association. They seem pretty active in the field and are promoting being a better landlord, which I kind of like their focus.
That's good.
So, yeah.
Well, I think, to a point they've been playing defense, I think, at the legislature.
Yes.
So I think that's part of what got it going that direction. Mm-hmm. All right, so third task I had outlined was get some stakeholder feedback, but basically identifying a list of stakeholders to engage, outreach materials, that kind of thing. Trying to reach as large an audience as possible, making sure that we're putting out materials in more than one language, English, Spanish, that kind of thing.
probably some combination of individual and focus group, maybe some hosted events, you know, so there won't be a ton of the hosted events, probably more the focus group and individual interviews, I think. Case studies is a chunk of this. You know, we're not talking about necessarily reinventing the wheel. There are, you know, national property maintenance codes that can be brought in. There are a lot of jurisdictions out there that already have programs of this nature. By and large, they do tend to be bigger communities with more staff capacity. But, you know, case studies, I think, will be a big piece of this. Model code. You're going to stand up a program. I mean, if you're going to have a toolkit, that's going to be an important part of it. Because you know, a small to medium-sized city is not going to want to be in a position where you have to invent a code from scratch. They're going to want something that at least has the key components in there, that these are the pieces you want to make sure are in a model code that you adopt locally if you're going to implement a program.
None of this commits Newport to implementing a program.
No, right. No, this is our... Right, the commitment at this point is just to provide local staff resources to assist the consultant in putting together this product. So there'll be staff time involved with coordinating meetings and bringing stakeholders to the table and that kind of thing.
Once it starts.
And then we have
a
rental maintenance code. The final report kind of just gels and pulls it all together. I kind of outlined a timeline here starting in January. I don't know. To me, it strikes me as about a 12-month process. Cascadia may have different thoughts on it. I mean, that can be adjusted somewhat depending on, you know, resources and, you know, for example, I mean, they might be able to do some things like memo one. I had it, I think, like over a 3-month period. Maybe they can get that done in 6 weeks. It's hard to say. So we can, that could all get adjusted somewhat. I think we want to make sure with stakeholder interviews, we want to provide ample time for that so it doesn't get short tripped. And probably could, case studies is one that maybe could get trimmed down a little bit. I think it'll take some time to get the model code pulled together and actually put in a nice, organized way and not just, you know, pulled from some jurisdiction's code and dropped in there. Anyway, did I miss anything? I mean, is there any other, outside of what I've jotted down right now, I've got looking into how effective existing processes are for getting these types of issues resolved. Concern about the impact to rents and landlords' willingness to continue to, you know, provide units if it gets too burdensome. Making it clear this is about month to month, not short-term rentals. Making sure there's renters, rental advocates, apartment owners, landlord association, Oregon Rental Housing Association, these types of folks on the advisory committee. Did I miss anything?
Have you ever thought about what happens in the event of an emergency? Like, I had rentals down in Santa Cruz County during the big Loma Prieta quake, and it was a disaster, believe me. And what happens where you have these renters that there's no place to go, FEMA gets involved, I mean, there's no water, there's no nothing, and it could happen here, especially with an earthquake here. But when you start thinking about emergency, you usually like to have the good contingency of the local people involved, where they know where the resources are. They mm-hmm. they kind of help one another, and I don't know if it can be addressed in this, but I had that happen. I never want to go through this. I had 5 rentals. I sold them all after that. I forgot them fixed up. The market went back. I got rid of it. I just didn't want to deal with it anymore.
This is, I'll jot down the emergency component. This is not tailored to address that specifically, and nor would we want that. I mean, we kind of tackle those on an emergency by emergency basis based on what we're dealing with.
Yeah.
How many homes are affected? How many apartment units are affected? You know, how many of them are unsafe to occupy versus those that maybe are occupiable but need repairs? You know, our building official or building officials in the area, we have relationships with the county.
Well,
where we would go through and kind of inventory and figure out where we're at.
There's some cases they don't even let the residents come back to the property. That's,
well, there's some cases where they can't because the units are not safe to occupy. But in those cases, we dealt with it on a very small scale up on 70th Drive, where we had multiple homes that were impacted. We were able to secure FEMA buyout money, and you know, some of those costs that they bore were reimbursable. But you know, they had to have family to help them. You know, there's only so far we can go with some of it. That's a good point.
I understand.
I wondered under model code if you wanted to try to sharpen the scope a little bit. You've indicated third-party contractor, in-house staff, or a hybrid of the two in order to deliver what's recommended.
Yeah.
But given it's small and medium-sized cities, I can't believe any one of them have excess staff capacity hanging around just waiting for something to do. So maybe it's just third-party contractor and hybrid. But an all-staff delivery seems asking too much of any small or medium city I can think of to implement any of this.
Okay.
But perhaps small level, managing the contractor probably is the most they can do, you know?
You know, the one thing that just off the animals were a huge problem with dogs and cats, really, but then some places had horses, they had some sort of cattle. They had chickens. It was a mess, nightmare. And when you go through a big disaster like that, you start thinking in terms of making sure you have the planning involved. And if you don't, man, you can lose it fast. Just look at Southern California with the fires down there.
John, I got the all-staff delivery as a item to talk to the consultant about. That's a fair point. We'll see what they say. I mean, they may still include it, but it may be caveated, you know, because I hear you. It's probably not one that's, but maybe there's some jurisdictions that have pulled it off. I don't know.
The county, Lincoln County, the county people have a very extensive plan for emergencies, including the animals, because they're building a new shelter, although the shelter's on the other side of down by Walport, where they're physically, here it was kind of, not good. And
when they had them by the middle school?
Yeah, but they had it by the middle school. So this place where they're going has several acres around it. So they're building a bigger building, and they're anticipating that if we have an emergency, I don't know about cattle, but they're gearing up for horses and llamas and some of that stuff.
Yeah,
I don't know that this particular task needs to address emergency situations. I think we're just getting started in this, and I just kind of start with basic maintenance. Maybe this is some of the mission creep that you referred to, but I think that's way too big a topic to include in this particular project.
Well, the city of Newport has an emergency management group here.
We do.
They do, yeah.
All right, that's all I had on that agenda item, Bill. I did just want to just briefly point out I did a little bit of an update to the work program. Get us to the first of the year at least. I want to let you know that from the next meeting, we are going to have a meeting on the 24th. We have a notice of public hearing, actually, on the 24th of November. That's the adjustment involving some undeveloped property on Nye Street. where they're looking to do a minimum lot size adjustment. And then I've got two work session items there. I've got the wastewater connection rebate program that we're going to be rolling out down in South Beach. I'd like to run through those parameters with you guys because I'll be taking that to council on the 1st of December, and which right around the corner from that date. And then we agreed to have further discussion about vacation rental rules as they apply to South Beach. That was the issue Gary Gamer raised at a work session. You agreed to look into it further, so I'll get that framed out. And then, probably expect to have a brief meeting on the 8th. There may be more than just what I've listed here, but that's all I've got, just the final order on the night, on the adjustment. No meeting on the 22nd of December, cancel. Nobody wants to meet the week of Christmas anyway. and then your organizational meeting will be the 12th of January. That should be 26, not 25. I'm bound to make a few Januaries.
What is an organizational meeting like, Derek?
Oh, it's just you guys have to appoint a new chair and vice chair. That's required at the beginning of the year. And the city manager's office should be recruiting the vacancy here anytime. We've covered that with them in terms of the vacancy on the planning commission. And John, to your point, Bob, if you want to step up and go for another term, please do so, and please submit a new application. That's the city's rules now. All right, that's all I had. Hey, 7:05.
The work session is adjourned and right on time, but we'll wait for Sherry to flip it over and get the recording going.